Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
Sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today, I have the pleasure of having Stuart Venery. He is an author of a program called The Government Makes Buying Homes More Expensive, a national real estate and mortgage expert. So if you'd like to speak with Stuart, give him a call at 347-324-3460, 347-324-3460. Or you can pose a question in the chat room, and I'll go ahead and read it on the air. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, Tim.
I guess to begin with, kind of tell us about yourself. How did you get started? And right now you're the president of Wilshire Holding Group.
Yes, I've been involved in real estate activities probably way over 40 years. And
wow.
I was a broker in California, in Nevada. I at one time owned the second largest mortgage company in Los Angeles County, which is not a small county by any means. I was a consultant to a casino in Las Vegas, helped arrange casino financing, and to Noah Dietrich, who was Howard Hughes's associate. And for many years, we provided down payment assistance for people getting homes, which unfortunately in 2008, the government said, you can't do that anymore. You can't help people get homes. So now we're helping people actually get out of over-encumbered real estate and at least get out with the least amount of problems when they find that it just doesn't make sense to keep their property. But I know a little bit about real estate anyway.
Well, that's a good thing. I guess kind of take us back real quick. Your journey as being a mortgage broker, being in the mortgage industry, kind of tell us in a nutshell, if you don't mind, back to 2008, and for some people who don't know what the details are, we only know what we heard from the media. Tell us what really happened.
What caused this crash?
What caused the crash?
It was a feeding. Yes, it was a feeding frenzy that was going on, and there was a lot of illegal activity happening, including all parties involved: real estate agents, mortgage brokers, Wall Street, of course, and then the people that were buying the homes whose names were going on title, buying property that no way they could possibly afford. But they weren't real estate professionals, so I don't think they have as much blame as the people that should have known better. But what really happened was many years ago, I remember when they first came out with no income verifying mortgages. And it was nothing like the product that it perverted itself into, Tim. When it first came out, they were made for very large loans, where people were putting typically 35% down payment. They were people with stellar credit, but people that had maybe 3-4-inch thick tax returns, where the underwriters who were looking at the loans couldn't figure out the income. And you could see $1 million or more cash flow, but they had a bottom line of $20,000, which wouldn't qualify them for anything. And those were good loans. By no means those were bad loans, but then it turned itself into a product where anybody, someone mowing a lawn, could say he was making $500,000 a year. And here we are today. People with property they can't afford.
$500,000 a year? Wow.
I mean, they were just signing their names to anything. And that's what created this debacle.
So then I think, this would bite them back, and eventually this is not going to last forever. You get all you can get right now and hit yourself, and, one day it's going to fall to pieces. They didn't realize that?
It's a giant Ponzi scheme, but the people that were doing it early, as illegal as it was, they were flipping it to other people, and who were in turn flipping it to other people. But like Bernie Madoff, eventually you're going to run out of people. And you can't, that's what a Ponzi scheme is. I mean, it would take everybody in the world over and over to keep it going, and you can't. The good thing that's come out of this, if you could call it something good, is young people today can buy a first home. They can get a home at a fair price. Interest rates are historically low. And it is a great time to buy. As bad a time as it is to sell, it's a great time to buy.
Wow. So out of this whole thing, you mentioned at the top of the hour, now you, the government don't allow you to do down payment assistance. That's what, I want to make sure I have that correct.
You can get some down payment assistance from a parent or a very close relative or a church, if possible, or your employer, which I haven't seen employers giving their employees gifts of down payments, but that is legal. But we used to provide a down payment assistance program that went on for many years, and we did help a lot of people, but that can't be done anymore because we're not a parent, in essence.
Now, what about, you know, that I know with the HUD program, they had several programs that do the development block grants will assist people in giving lower rates, also giving down payment assistance. Is that still legal from the city that fosters
the program? There's a little bit of that, but I think you're seeing less of that, and I think you should see less of that because people really should afford to qualify for their home today. And today you could get a lot more home than you could a few years ago. FHA, HUD loans are still probably the best way to get into a house with as little down as possible. You can still buy a home with as little as 3.5% down on an FHA loan. And the qualification is a little easier, I think, than a conventional loan. But it's a good way to get into a first home for sure.
Okay. Gray, I have some questions here, but we're going to dive into the other information about why the government is making it more expensive to buy a home today.
Well, I don't really think they're making it that more expensive. I mean, people are saying that, but what they're doing is they're raising the mortgage insurance premium slightly on an FHA loan. Now, we've all heard of mortgage insurance, and I think they use the word PMI a lot, which we have all heard of, which is private mortgage insurance, which insures the lender in case of a default, and the borrower buys this insurance, has to buy it when he's putting a smaller down payment. Now, the equivalent to that is FHA, which is called MMI, which is Mutual Mortgage Insurance, which is really the same as the PMI, but it's a government insurance program. And they've had a lot of losses, so they've raised the rates slightly. But still, interest rates are so historically low that extra maybe quarter of a point that you'd be paying when you're getting a loan at under 4% is not so bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can still get into a house very easily today if you have a little bit of savings or a little help from your parents or close relative.
Okay.
But you must qualify.
So,
I mean, that's the caveat. You must qualify. You must be able to have a job to be able to prove your income, have fairly decent credit, and show that you manage your credit cards responsibly.
Okay. Let's take the question of qualifications and credit. How can a person today qualify for a loan?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, there's three elements to get a mortgage. One is out of your control to an extent, which is the appraisal, because obviously you're going to buy a piece of property, and that property is the collateral for the loan. But that's what you have an appraiser for, to be sure that the bank is making a loan within the guidelines of what it's worth, and that you, for your own protection, are buying a house that's worth that much. Now, within your control is you have to qualify for credit and income. Income, you typically should have at least 2 years working in the same profession. It doesn't mean you have to have 2 years on the same job, but if you went from one company to another in the same field, that would work. You can't say I've worked 2 years if you've gone from a greeter at Walmart to a nuclear scientist. Of course, you know, if you were a nuclear scientist in Iran, you might be better off as a greeter at Walmart, but it would be safer. But you have to work in the same profession, and then you have to have income that isn't about a third of your income should cover your principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and mortgage insurance, if that's applicable. And then maybe another 10-15% of that income to cover fixed monthly consumer credit, credit cards, auto loans, that sort of thing. And you do that, you should be able to afford your payment theoretically. And then obviously the third element is they look at your credit because you have to show a certain amount of responsibility.
So a person typically coming into this whole system, this new Pulse 2008 system, appraisal, okay, they can take care of that. The income, okay, they can take care of that. You're saying as long as they have a third of their income that don't go over a third to service the debt and the more than 10 to 15% of their fixed monthly expenses, outside of that, they should be able to afford a home.
Yes, you should. And if you can't meet that minimal criteria, then you're what's called a renter. And you do what,
okay.
You know, what most of us did, or at least I did when I was young, is we rented and saved for a down payment and bought our first home.
Okay.
And that's, I think, the American dream.
There you go. So on credit itself, well, let's go back down to go back to credit, and then we'll go back to down payment, because I know that's going to be the main question people are going to have. When you're dealing with credit, is it, you know, if you're 700, you're 800, it's a no-brainer. When you get to the 600s, then you get into the area, you have good credit, but you're slowly going down to fair credit. Your rates are going to be higher, of course. Is there a breakoff point that a person really, really should say, hey, I need to do something about this particular credit in order to raise my credit to get a better rate?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
No, I think when you get into the 600s, you have to start looking at your credit, and you have to start figuring out what's making your score going down like this. And I really hate this FICO credit scoring. I mean, the old days they used to use common sense underwriting, but there are certain things that, again, should not be able taken into consideration, and the lenders sometimes can work with that, like medical bills and things like that should not lower your credit score that much. But a bankruptcy or foreclosure, that can seriously hurt you, like 200 points.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example,
be careful.
Go ahead.
No,
okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Like, for example, about a few years before before 2008, before the crash in September, you know, if you have like a 650, it's automatic scoring. You put you in a different category, and you really can get an automatic approval for certain things at 650 and above. Then I think after that, then they raise their score to 25 points to 675 to get the automatic, you know, without having any other type of verification today. But taken back, when you get really under 640, you get in that marginal error. Even down to really 620, then you really get into bad credit. Is it the same case today? If a person has a 650 and above, they meet that benchmark, they can get a mortgage, long as they have the third, that won't they can use for payment. Third meaning that it won't exceed the third, to make
right.
the monthly payment, and then that don't go to the no higher than 15% on their fixed costs. So if they have that recipe, they should be able to qualify and close.
Yes. What I think the problem today is a lot of the subprime lenders have gone out of business, and I think there's a big market for subprime because there are people that don't really quite meet that threshold. But if you can afford the payment and qualify at maybe 2% higher interest, then you still get your house if you can, because it's a great time to buy, and then it gives you an opportunity to behave properly, manage your credit properly, and then refinance at a later date for a paper loan. Hopefully rates will stay low like this.
Okay.
You know,
so
the best
at,
loan, I always told people, just one thing, what I always told people when I was in the mortgage business, I mean, they would say, well, what's the best loan? I said, the best loan is the one that's going to close.
Absolutely.
And that's the best loan, the one that you can get.
If you go back to the credit scoring itself, and you have some people on one extreme, you have some people with, you know, if you come out of college, you've been, you know, you have a low credit, is kind of a no-brainer because you will be in probably in that 600, high 600 range. Some went to 700 as long as they've been responsible in their credit cards and so forth. And we have this new job that's pretty like an engineer or whatever with a company that's verifiable and pretty secure. If you take that the candidate that have a couple of bumps and bruises, but they're really over 650, I know we were hearing horror stories. I'm going to segue real quick. Horror stories a year ago. People in the 700s having difficulty because the bank want them to put more and more money down, and they were almost at 20%. Is that the same case today? Well, you know, even the banks are barking at 20% down, which is a significant amount of money.
A lot of that with the banks was a result of Dodd-Frank, some of that legislation that was making it pretty hard on banks. The consumer protection was making the banks hold a financial stake in these mortgages rather than sell them on the secondary market. But I think if I were in the scenario that you described, I seriously would look at FHA. That's the way to go today. FHA has become, I hate to say the word, but like the new subprime or the B paper.
Okay.
You can get a loan with FHA if you're at the scenario, as I say, that you just described.
Okay. And that's if you're a first-time buyer. If you already have an FHA
No, you can get it
loan.
Anyway. For your primary residence, you can get it. For your primary residence.
Okay.
What's kind of dried up is money for second homes and investment property in single families. That's hard to get today.
Okay. Now, if that same person who have a house somewhere else and a renter is paying for it and they have to relocate or whatever, they get another home. I have a question right here I think someone asked earlier. If the person defaulted on an FHA and there was no balance outstanding, will they qualify for another FHA?
Well, the problem you have there is once you've defaulted, that foreclosure is going to hit your record for a long time. This is what we're actually in our business. We're helping people work through this. But I'd like to see, personally, I'd like to see a change, and I think this would help the housing market enormously. If Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, which are really all under government control today, if they allowed people who have had a year after a foreclosure, who've shown responsibility and have jobs that can otherwise qualify to get back and get an A-paper loan. But today I think you're going to have to wait at least over 2 years for an FHA loan and probably 4 years for a conventional loan.
Okay, I follow. Now, I've noticed a lot of people today have been cleaning up their credit. They clean up to their credit, they don't have nothing. In the sense that I've seen in a dealership when I was working finance, I had like a 55-year-old person who were not a ghost. They had the, I guess they wiped everything off their credit to the point they didn't have anything. And will that will work in a mortgage situation? Are you really going to have some proven credit?
Well, I think that's a very weird and unusual situation with computers today, how you can be completely a ghost. But I have seen that actually myself.
Mm-hmm.
But in cases like that, get copies of rent receipts, utility bills, canceled checks. You know, all of that can be used as an alternative. But that's a very rare case that you're going to see someone that's just out of the computer.
Yeah, they in the computer is to have a timestamp, I think. They must work with a credit agency that disputed so much off their credit that really they end up with very maybe one charge line at the very end, but everything got wiped out totally, and they only had like one trade line that was recent, and it was not uncommon. Yeah.
That's okay.
So that's
again, back it up with utility bills. Get, you know, because you are, if you're paying your electric bill, you've got credit, and you're paying it, and the same with your phone or whatever utilities you have, that will help.
Okay. Also, within that same scenario, when it comes to your building your credit, when the people that have liens and judgments, some people will be able to get those liens and judgments off their credit report. However, the liens and judgments are still there, so when they do a search, they still can be able to find it. If that's the true case?
Yes, and it will hurt you, but you're going to have a hard time getting a loan if you have an open judgment or lien, because what happens is they file an abstract, and that would actually be a lien on the new property ahead of the mortgage. So the lender is going to want to see that gone.
Okay. And when it comes to people who have bankruptcies, are they able to qualify if they've been discharged?
A few years, probably 4 years minimum.
Okay.
But sometimes, you know, if someone is in that position and they have to go bankrupt, they have to. I mean, your first priority is to feed and clothe your family and survive. And today, a lot of people are fighting for survival. It's not easy.
Okay. Kind of explain to us real quick. I know you talked about the PMI and the MMI. Tell us, what is Freddie Mac and what is Freddie Mae?
Well, for what is Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae?
Mm-hmm.
They are, that's Federal National Mortgage Association and then Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation. They are very similar, if not almost identical. They're quasi-government, the way they were established. I'd love to have a business like this myself, where profits are privatized and losses are socialized, which is what it is. Now, today, they're pretty much completely under government control because all of the bailouts that have been given to them. But they buy mortgages, bundle them as securities, and sell them on Wall Street, which is what they do. The days of banks keeping loans have long passed. Used to be when you, a long time ago, when you'd go to get a loan, you'd go to your local savings and loan, which I believe had the requirements that they could lend within 50 miles of their individual branch, and that was a source of money. But with deregulation and everything changing and Wall Street coming in, all loans today are sold on the secondary market. They're bundled as securities and sold on Wall Street, which is where so much of the problem has occurred today, because they took loans, for example, the Countrywide portfolio that Bank of America bought. It was a toxic portfolio of loans. I'm not saying every loan was bad, but so many of them were really bad loans, and they were sold on Wall Street as A paper securities, and they were sold all over the world. That's what bankrupted the government of Iceland. And I mean, the ripple.
So that was legal?
Terrific.
I mean, that they could take.
Well, and it shouldn't be legal, but that's what—that's why so many of these Wall Street companies got into trouble, and so many are making a fortune. AIG, the same kind of thing, got in trouble with this. They were insuring these derivatives. I mean, you're looking at a big, massive money laundering Ponzi scheme in reality, and they were selling junk as diamonds.
Is there a system, you know, I know the saying is too big to fail. I mean, the government had to step in to, I guess, part of this whole thread was AIG, and they could not, of course, they could not let Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae fail. But however, when it came to AIG, they couldn't let that fail because it was part of the fabric that was holding things together. What was so special about AIG?
Well, they were buying, and they were, that was derivatives. And a derivative, which is kind of an interesting thing in of itself, this is getting kind of technical, but back at the turn of the century, I'm talking about the 1900s, there was something going on called bucket shops. And what bucket shops were gambling on securities. You weren't actually investing in the company. You weren't investing in the security or in the business, but you were gambling whether it would go up or go down, and you were hedging your funds, come hedge funds. And that was outlawed, I believe, in 1905 or something like that under President Taft. It was brought back under Clinton called derivatives. But it's really nothing more than the old bucket shops that were made illegal 100 and something years ago. And all of this led to this problem. And then you have so much greed. For example, the savings and loans collapsed in the early 80s when they allowed the savings and loans to not just make loans on homes in their neighborhood, but to invest in hotels and commercial enterprises. And the savings and loan collapse cost the taxpayer something like, I think, $150 billion. Now we're dealing with T's, not B's. But the same thing happened again then when they allowed the banks to diversify into areas that they shouldn't. For example, when Citibank bought Travelers Insurance, I believe, they became Citigroup.
Mm-hmm.
And these banks are buying brokerage houses. So you have the same people originating the loans, packaging the loans, selling them to their other subsidiaries, and eventually going out to the general public. And you've got way too incestuous a relationship going on. And when you do this, you have so much greed and all these people making huge amounts of money along the way. In the end, the taxpayers end up paying for it.
Wow. Hey, what advice would you give a person who is look like they're facing issues with a particular mortgage? What advice would you give them? The first thing they really need to do?
Well, the first thing you need to do is get some very competent and sound advice, and you're not going to get it from your real estate agent. Unfortunately, your real estate agent probably took a 30-hour test to get his license or her license. Where your barber probably took 1,000 hours of education to get his license.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a comparison.
Wow.
There are some issues that are very serious right now. There's the Mortgage Debt Forgiveness Act, which is expiring this year, which will protect someone from having to pay income tax on what the lender loses when they write a loan off.
Mm-hmm.
But you hear a lot of this information out on the air and from real estate agents and on television and radio, but they're not giving you the whole story, or maybe they don't know the whole story. But they'll say you've got to do a short sale on your house now because otherwise next year you'll have to pay tax on what the lender writes off. But the Mortgage Debt Forgiveness Act will protect you on your primary residence only to the extent of your first loan, to the amount of your original loan. So many people bought houses a long time ago, and in the height of the market, they refied it and they took cash out. And if they didn't use that money for home improvement, if they used it for any other purpose, credit cards, cars, vacations, college, anything else, that would be taxable income, and that is not protected by the Mortgage Debt Forgiveness Act. So someone could be getting some partial advice or not complete advice and could end up with a horrific tax bill to have to pay.
Wow.
So you need to really look at your picture carefully, and sometimes a short sale is not the best answer. They're very difficult to do, very hard to complete, and in the end, the only one who might make a little money might be a real estate agent getting a commission, but you could end up being hurt worse than walking away from the property.
So what how can you be hurt if you just say, hey, you can have the house and I just walk away from it versus just letting it foreclose?
Well, that would be the same thing, in essence. It would be
okay.
The same thing. It would impact your credit, number one. But the credit will come back eventually. But you could be faced with a serious tax consequence, and that's, I think, the most important matter to consider. We do help people a lot with this. If they wanted to call us, I'm more than happy to explain this. We don't charge anything to talk to them. And I don't know, I don't think you gave our exact number. You may have given one of our internal phone lines, but our number is 877-94-HELP-ME.
Okay. And, again, what's your website address for people to know?
RealtyCrisis.com.
Okay.
And if you get a Japanese rock and roll band, you spelled wrong. You spelled reality. It's RealtyCrisis.com.
Realty.
I'm not Japanese, and I don't do rock and roll.
Well, I guess you have the experience of that. And kind of tell us how your organization normally help homeowners who are distressed like that?
Number one, we'll try to get them in the right direction. But if someone's in a situation where they must get out and they're upside down in equity, what we do is mm-hmm. we buy the property for the amount of the debt, and we force the bank then to take a loss under our ownership. That will protect them from the tax consequences, and for credit purposes, they have a very well-documented transaction. And we also let the people live in the property as our house sitter rent-free. And we don't charge a lot for this. It's typically no more than what one payment would be. But
okay.
We make a little bit. We don't get rich on it, but we help a lot of people get out of a big mess. Been doing this over 18 years, in fact.
So let's walk us through the whole process so they can sell the property to you. Then that takes them out of the loop for that tax consequences. Then what happens? You negotiate with the bank.
And we're going to force the bank to take a loss. We play hardball with them.
Okay.
And
then the bank
takes
the...
But they don't have a choice.
So, but you allow the tenant to stay, I mean, the previous homeowner to stay there for, to watch the property for a while, or
yes.
How long this
yes.
process? Okay.
Well, we typically own these properties about a year, so it gives them a chance to get back on their feet a little bit and save a little money. And this is not true if it's a rental property. We have to take over that property. But if they're living in it, it does give them a chance to get back on their feet.
Okay. But it'd be less than what they would be paying before.
Oh, we only charge them one fee, which is about the equivalent of one payment typically. Not very much.
Oh, wow. And they can be able to live in the property for up to a year.
Yes, sir. And at least they're not going to have to worry about the tax issue. And for credit purposes, it is a very well-documented transaction.
Now, let's flip it real quick. The person who owes more than the property is worth. So say you owe $120,000, but now because of the pricing of homes, now it's worth way less. Say it took a $25,000 hit. Now you're at 120. Now is worth, which are tax rolls at 95. Is that going to be the market value, or is this just a tax roll amount? And is that really the perceived value of the property now?
Well, the perceived value is the market value. I mean, a property is
okay.
worth what someone's going to pay for it.
Okay.
But if they owe $125,000, that's the number they have to work with, and that's the figure that we would buy it for, and then we would deal with the bank. But that property may be worth $95,000. It may be worth $50,000 when you're done with the final analysis.
Okay.
You know, you never know at this point what they're worth.
Okay. And your company will handle all that information, and in every state?
Pretty much every state. We work almost all over the country. Some states are better than others.
Okay.
But we deal all over the country.
Now, do you have a question here, an affiliate and a broker. Do your company take affiliate brokers as well? Or
we do. We work with a lot of realtors.
Okay.
And we need them we try to sell these properties at short sale as well, so we need the brokers to work with us for that. And when we do that, we list them with them, and we help them negotiate a short sale. They're hard to do, but it's much better for the short sale to be under our ownership than under the previous owners.
Okay. And you work directly with the realtors?
Yes, we have a department that just handles that, yes.
Okay. And lastly, when it comes to the mortgage broker business, is it harder today to become a mortgage broker? Can a person succeed becoming a mortgage broker today? A lot of Still hard today.
Oh, well, a lot of them have gone out of business, but there's some national licensing that you have to learn and bonding and credit requirements. It's not nearly as easy as it used to be, but probably in a way that's good because you should have a little more qualified and better qualified person. If I were, for your listening audience, if I were looking for a mortgage and looking for a mortgage broker, I think I'd look for someone who's been around a while, because today in packaging and processing a loan, it's like we used to do 20-something years ago. And a lot of the ones that just started during this crazy times that we had, they're kind of flash in the pans. They might know how to work a computer, but they don't know how to analyze a tax return. And today you've got to have people that have some competence.
Okay.
Look for experience.
Look for experience. In closing, any additional advice that you have of a person that you'd like to close out with, maybe a summary about your program or something you'd like to leave with the audience?
Well, what I'd like to say is that if you're looking to sell a home And if you're underwater, we would be glad to help them and talk to them, because this is a serious matter. Before you do anything, we'd love to talk to them if they're upside down in their property. If you're a buyer, and if there's any way that you can get your home, especially a first-time home buyer or a young family, try to do it and go for it. And the first step you should do is get pre-approved for an amount of a loan. If you're approved for $100,000, then look for a loan of $90,000. Go on the, don't try to go for the max. You're going to get a lot more than you would have got a few years ago. And be conservative. That's my best advice for a buyer.
Okay, be conservative. Okay. And how to contact you one last time. So you know, you say
Realty Crisis. RealtyCrisis.com, or they can call it 877-94-HELP-ME.
Okay. Well, Stuart, I appreciate you coming on to the program and kind of sharing us with a lot of information. Thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, my friend. You have a great day.
Take care. Okay.
Bye.
Again, bye. This has been another production of the Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. You can download this episode on iTunes on Blog Talk Radio Network. Thank you for listening, everybody, and everybody have a great week. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For more information about equipment financing and asset-based loans, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. Or call us at 866-611-7457. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to the Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. And thanks again for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.